Been a bestseller for 1600 years. It's still doing very well, and I'm very grateful to you for being here. I'm very grateful to Jean, Father Bernard, Father David for giving their time and their interest to read it to us. This is a true story. Going back a few years, when Father Billy was in charge here, two youngsters came from Haverhill one Sunday afternoon on their bicycles, aged 15 and 16. And they were fortunate enough to run into Father Billy. So they were guaranteed a big welcome. They were shown around the house, the grounds, with a lengthy discourse on the legend of Clare, which is on the carved and the mantelpiece in the library of the Upton Hillbury. He fed them tea and Nora's thumbs. And then when they were leaving, he gave them each a little slim booklet written by Father Matthew Cullen of the life of Augustine. A week later, they were back on their bicycles. Could they hear more about this man? Augustine, they were very interested. Could they read anything that he had written? So Billy went into the library and searched all the shelves and found there was nothing he could put in the hands of a 15 or 16 year old. So he came to me and said, "What can I give them?" I said, "There's nothing that's really written for a 15 or 16 year old. What a pity there isn't." So that's my reason for writing this.
So this is the early years of his life up to his conversion, when he was aged
34.
The life of Augustine as told in his confessions. He should really have been called Patrick after his father, but his parents gave him the name of Augustine, named him after the Emperor Augustus. So little Augustus he became. He would in time be far more famous than the man who at that time ruled a vast Roman Empire. The year was 354, the place present-day Algeria. So African by birth, Roman by education. Not very well off, his parents found that he was a boy of some intelligence. So they made sure that he went to a good school in a neighbouring town, where quickly he made his mark. But then, when he was 15, the money ran out. Father, who had saved and scraped to pay the fees, could no longer afford them. So he was brought home and spent a year doing nothing, except getting into mischief. A wealthy patron was found, and the boy went back to school. From that day onward, Augustine was set on a road that would lead to great success in terms of career. He would land a job in the Emperor's inner circle. Let us hear his own account of his school days.
"I was sent to school so that I could learn to read, though I, poor lad, could see no value in study. When I was lazy at learning, I was beaten. This system was sanctioned by grown-ups. Many a young person before me had followed this rough road, and we were driven along that same road, adding to the toil and misery of the children of Adam. On that road, however, we found people who prayed to you, and we learnt to do the same, imagining you as best we could, as someone with great power, able to hear us and help us, though beyond the reach of our senses. So it was that as a boy I began to pray to you, my help, my refuge. My tongue was loosened in prayer. Though I was but a little lad, I prayed with no little devotion that I might be spared the rod. And you, to save me from being a fool, you did not hear me. The grown-ups laughed at the beatings. Even my parents did, and they certainly wished me no harm. But those beatings were the plague of my life, my most dreadful misery. But we still were at fault for being less attentive to our reading, our writing, and studying than was expected of us. It was not that we lacked memory or ability, Lord, for you had given up these generously enough to suit our age. But we loved to be playing, and we were punished by adults who played their own games. When the grown-up people play games, it is called business. The games that children play are not much different, yet for all that they are punished by those same people, no one is sorry for either the young folk or the grown-ups. Would any sensible judge approve of the beatings I got for playing ball when I was a boy, and was thereby hindered from learning the tricks and that would prepare me to play uglier games later. Was my fault, I wonder, any worse than that of the teacher who flogged me, who, being put down by a colleague in some trifling argument, raged with anger and spite more than I did when I lost to any opponent at a ball game. I hated to be wrong. I had a lively memory. I was being well trained in the use of words. Friendship soothed my soul, and I shrank from pain, servility, and ignorance. That such a little fellow enjoyed such precious gifts, is that not something to shout about? But all these are gifts from God. I did not give them to myself, beautiful gifts. And together they make me what I am. So he who made me is good, and all that is good in me is his. In him I delight. Him I thank for all the gifts I enjoyed, even as a little boy. But my great error in life was this, that I looked for pleasure, for truth, for beauty, not in him, but in the things he had made. In myself and in others, and thus I fell into confusion, into error, into pain. To you, my God, be thanks, you who are now my delight. You I honour, you I trust. To you, my God, I give thanks for my gifts, for your gifts. Keep them safe and protect them for me. So you will keep me safe, and all your gifts to me shall grow and flourish. And so I will be with you, because this too is your gift to me, that I exist.
The Confessions are not the story of a poor but clever boy's rise to a position of great prestige at the top of a ladder. The book is the story of his inner life, of his search for truth and happiness, his search for God. His father was a pagan and only interested in the boy's career prospects. The mother, Monica, had a different agenda. Though keen to promote his obvious gifts, she was determined that he would be a Christian. She would never rest until she saw him a Catholic Christian. From his earliest years, she tried to make him love Jesus. His father never stood in the way of his religious upbringing.
From the moment of birth, my mother, who strongly trusted in you, blessed me regularly with the sign of the cross and put salt in my mouth. You know, Lord, how one day when I was a boy, I was struck by a violent stomach seizure, which brought on a fever, from which I almost died. You know too, my God, who were even then my protector, how I begged to be baptized into your Christ, who is my Lord and God. I pleaded with my mother, and pleaded with the Church, which is the mother of us all. In her strong, pure faith, she who had given me my bodily life was as anxious for my birth into eternal life as she had been for my physical birth. Had I not recovered, she would have urgently set about arranging for me to receive the cleansing grace of the sacraments of salvation and to be washed clean by confessing my sins to you. The baptism was deferred. For it was believed that if I were baptized and, as was likely, I lapsed back into sin, my guilt would be so much greater.
In that idle year, when he was 16, Monica watched Augustine drift away from his Catholic faith and begin to sow his wild oats. The road he chose at that time would lead him further and further away from God, but we will hear that story a little later. After that wasted year, he is back at school, aged 17, and intent on making a success of his studies. But away from his mother's influence, he took full advantage of his freedom, especially in the area of sexuality, and this was to be the chain that bound him for many years. He also, at university, joined a gang called the Wreckers, going about their vandalism in the late nights. Still only 17, he moves in with his mistress, a girl he had courted at church. She was from a social class that, if he was to go up in his profession, would rule out marriage. He chose her, he tells us, because my sexual fancy had, in its ceaseless search, picked her out. He was to remain faithful to her for 15 years. She was the only woman I had in those years, he tells us. They hadn't planned to have a child, but when Augustine was 19, they had a son. They named him Adeodatus, or Gift from God. And Augustine greatly loved him. But his aim to cut a fine figure among his university peers had to give way to baby-minding and domestic chores. But his ambition to be successful and wealthy meant he kept his head down at the studies. So let's catch up on his soul's journey at this point. At 19, he read a book on philosophy, and he fell in love with the idea of devoting his life to discovering wisdom. But his excitement was hampered by the fact that philosophy, as he read it, had no place for Christ. That name I had imbibed with my mother's milk, and I kept it deep within me. And no book, however true or beautiful, could fully interest me if the name of Christ were missing from it.
The book delighted me and set me on fire. Only one thing dampened my eagerness. The name of Christ was not there. By your mercy, Lord, this name my little heart sucked in at my mother's breast. The name of your Son, my Saviour. Deep down, it had remained with me. No book, however true, however beautifully written, could wholly captivate me unless the name of Christ were there.
This experience led him back to the person of Christ, who had been at the centre of the faith he had been taught by his mother. So he began to look for the first time at the sources of Christian faith. He went first to the Old Testament, hoping to find wisdom there. He found the style crude and the stories, many of them, immoral. So he was sidetracked. He took up an esoteric religion called Manichaeism, a very clever mixture of Christianity and paganism. It seemed intellectually satisfying and made no moral demands. So he stuck with it for the next 10 years. He would have liked to be more moral, but not yet. Lord, give me chastity, but not just yet. And as a Manichae, he became, like them, very opposed to Catholicism. He used his great intelligence to try to wean away many people from it. One of the things he greatly valued about his new religion was its stress on friendship. All his life, Augustine had a deep appreciation for friendship. His choice of career takes him into teaching. Finished at university, he goes back home to Tagaste, where he sets up as a teacher of what was called rhetoric, public speaking. He is now 22. There, his love of friendship was blessed by his finding a real soulmate. But the friendship was short-lived, the young friend died, and Augustine's life was thrown into turmoil. Here is one of the most powerful accounts anywhere in literature on the death of a friend.
When I first began teaching in my native town, Tagaste, I made a wonderful friend. We were of equal age and had the same interests. It was the golden time of our youth. We grew up as boys together, went to school together, and we played together. Yet the friendship between us was not the truest, either then or later. The truest friendship is only possible when you, Lord, bind friends together by that love which is poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who is given to us. But that friendship was a delight, grounded in the interests we shared. I drew him away from the true faith, in which, as a boy, he was not deeply rooted. I lured him into the dark superstitions and dangerous beliefs which caused my mother to weep many tears for me. Now, as a grown-up, his mind was astray with me, and my soul was lost without him. But you were close, close as you always are, on the heel, close on the heels of those who run away from you. God of justice, and equally God of compassion, You bring us back to you in ways we cannot understand. You took my friend from this life before our friendship was fully a year old, and that friendship was more delightful to me than anything I had ever known. Who is there who can count the blessings which you bestow on any one person? How then, my God, can I understand what you did at that time? How understand the deep, hidden abyss of your judgments? My friend was critically ill with a fever. He lay unconscious in a deathly fever for a long time. When the family lost hope of his recovery, they had him baptized without his knowing. I had no worry about that. I assumed that he was likely to hold on to what he had learnt from me and not what had been done to him while he was unconscious. How differently it turned out. He recovered and was restored to health. At once, as soon as I could talk to him, which was as soon as he could talk to me, for I never left his side since we depended so much on each other, I tried to joke with him about the baptism. I imagined that he would join me in mocking what he had endured when he was incapable of any thought or feeling. But he had been told about it, and now he looked at me with horror as though I were an enemy. With an independence that was new and amazing, he turned on me. If I wished to remain his friend, he said, would I please stop talking like that? Astounded, I kept my feelings to myself, waiting to talk sense to him when he was fully recovered. And I would be able to do that, and I would be able to do what I liked to him again. But he was rescued from my mad schemes and taken into your safe keeping for my later comforting. Within a few days, the fever returned and he died, and I was not there. My heart plunged into the darkest of griefs. Whatever I looked on spoke to me of death. My own homeland became a torment, my home a strangely unhappy place. All the things we shared became daily torture because he was not there. My eyes searched for him everywhere and did not find him. I hated all my old haunts because they were without him. Nor could they whisper, "He is coming," as they did when he was alive but absent. I had become a great puzzle to myself, always asking why I was so sad and why I was so disturbed, but finding no answer. If someone had said, "Trust in God," my soul would have rebelled, because the one I had lost was more dear to me and more real than the unknown one in whom I was urged to trust. My tears were my only comfort. They had taken over my heart in place of my friend.
So he felt he had to leave the place. He goes back to the city of Carthage to teach there. He spends about 7 years there and made a name for himself. But eventually his pupils got too much for him. They were rowdy. Young men, not his own pupils, would rush into his classes, create havoc, and then rush off. Someone told him that Rome was the place to go to. The students there were well behaved, and the pay was better. So at the age of 29, he makes the move to Rome, but not without his mother's opposition. She was very worried about his rebellion against the church. She would not let him go without her. So we get the story of his sly tactics to get away from her.
You knew, my God, the real reason why I left Carthage and went to Rome, but you did not reveal it to me, nor to my mother. She wept bitterly to see me go and followed me to the seafront. There she held on to me with every ounce of strength she had, pleading with me to come back home, or else to take her with me. I fooled her by pretending that there was a friend whom I could not leave, until the wind changed and his ship could set sail. I lied to my mother, and to such a mother. I escaped, but you dealt with me mercifully, for you kept me safe from the waters of the sea, laden though I was by my detestable faults. And you brought me to the streams of your grace in baptism. This was the water that washed me clean. Once I was washed in that, the tears from my mother's eyes would be dried up, tears with which day by day she bedewed the ground, whenever she prayed to you for me. But at that time, she was set on not going home without me. It was with difficulty that I persuaded her to spend the night in a little chapel dedicated to St. Cyprian, which was near the ship. In the night, unknown to her, I slipped away, and left her to her prayers and her weeping. And what was she begging of you, my God, with her many tears? Surely it was that you would not allow me to set sail. You did not grant what she desired at that moment, but true to your higher purpose, you met the deeper wish of her heart, for you planned to make me what she had always asked for. She loved to have me with her, like most mothers, and more than most. Little did she know the joys you would create for her through my absence. She did not know, and so she wailed and wept. Those torments showed the legacy of Eve in her, for she sought in sorrow the child she had brought to birth in sorrow. But finally she stopped complaining about my deceit and my cruelty. She turned again to you in prayer for me. She went back home, and I went to Rome.
He came to Rome and immediately went down with a bad fever. He was close to death. He recovered, but his expectations of a better life as a teacher were soon shattered. His pupils were better behaved than at Carthage, but they had the audacity to disappear at the end of term when the fees were due. Fortunately, a job at the Emperor's court at Milan became vacant as professor of rhetoric, just the post suited to him. Augustine had made good friends who used their influence. He was interviewed and got the post. So, just a year after he came to Rome, a city he disliked because it was overcrowded and its sewers stank, he left for Milan. He was just coming up to 30. His reputation was enough to attract good pupils. He was on the road to fulfil his ambition to be wealthy and to climb higher in the social scale. But all his successes did not bring him happiness. His soul was restless. If good fortune smiled on me, I was too weary to lay hold of it. Almost before I could get my hands on it, it was off in flight. He was weary, too, of the task that came with the job, making speeches in praise of the emperor on public occasions. He describes his state of mind at the time in this passage.
What misery! You lance my wound so as to goad my soul to leave all behind and turn to you, to turn and be healed by you, who are, above all, without whom nothing would exist. And you made me aware of my misery. I remember the day. I was preparing to deliver a eulogy in praise of the emperor. That meant telling many lies, and being applauded by an audience which well knew the falseness of what I said. So my heart was pounding with anxiety, my mind agitated with frantic thoughts. I was walking down a certain street in Milan, and noticed a poor beggar, half drunk, but laughing. I sighed and said something to the friends who were with me, something about the pain and misery we bring on ourselves by our own folly. Here was I, driven by greed, dragging along my load of misery, feeling it all the heavier for its being dragged. And the sole purpose of all the effort was to find some sort of secure happiness. The beggar had already beaten us to it, while we would probably never find it. He was already enjoying it at the cost of a few pennies which he had begged. I was straining for it by turning and twisting this way and that. At stake was the pleasure of a little passing happiness. His joy was not true happiness. But I and my ambition were seeking an even falser happiness. He was full of contentment. I was full of anxiety. He was without a care in the world. I was worried. If someone were to ask me, did I want to be happy or anxious, I would of course say, happy. What I asked further, did I want to be like the beggar, or be as I was at that moment, I would have chosen to be as I was, full of worries and fears. But it would be a perverse choice, not a true one, wouldn't it? I could not have preferred my situation to his because of my better education, since that was not a source of happiness to me, and since I use it not to teach others, but to win people's favour. For this you broke my bones with the rod of your discipline. I have no time for those who say to my soul, but it is important to know what the cause of a person's happiness is. The beggar was happy because of the wine he had drunk. You, because you seek glory. But Lord, what kind of glory was it? It was not the kind that is found in you. As the beggar's happiness was not true happiness, so neither was my glory true glory. Yet it went to my head. The beggar would sleep off the drunkenness that night, but my misery was with me when I went to sleep and when I woke. And so it would be each time I slept and woke, for God knows how long. Why a person is happy, does I know, matter. And the happiness that springs from Christian hope cannot be compared with the shallow happiness I then pursued. There was another difference between the beggar and me. He was certainly a happier man than I was, because he was in high spirits, while I was eaten up with anxiety. But he was also happy, because he had earned his wine by wishing good day to passers-by, whereas I, by spinning lies, was feeding my vain glory.
And then Monica arrives, all the way from North Africa, and with her the mistress and son whom he had left behind. While Monica was mainly worried that he had not found the true faith, she was also conscious that he couldn't, according to Roman law, marry his common law wife. Augustine had to face the terrible choice, either to give up his mistress or give up the hope of further advancement. Further advancement would have been the governorship of a Roman colony, a bit like in the early 1900s becoming Governor General of Canada in the British Empire. So the mistress had to go, and a more suitable wife found for him. He tells about the distress this caused him and his long-time mistress, and how when his mother and friends found an acceptable girl for him as wife, he couldn't wait the 2 years till she was legally of age to marry.
Meanwhile, my sins were piling up. The woman with whom I had been living was torn from my side, because she was regarded as an obstacle to my marriage. My heart, deeply attached to her, was ripped open and ran blood. She went back to Africa, vowing you never to give herself to another man. And the son born of our union she left with me. But I, thoroughly miserable, was unable to follow her woman's example. Impatient at having to wait 2 years to marry, I found myself another woman. I was no lover of marriage, rather a slave of my lust. By this liaison, the sickness of my soul would be nurtured, and indeed made worse. And through the force of hardened custom, would carry over into marriage. The other wound, made by the severance of my first mistress, did not heal. The pain, sharp and piercing, began to fester. And though the immediate ache became dull, I despaired of ever being healed.
But his soul's restlessness and distress was soon to find a source of comfort. Augustine, at Monica's prompting, urged him to go and listen to Ambrose, the bishop, a man famous as a preacher and orator. Augustine went out of curiosity to hear a great orator, not in the least wanting to take in the content of the sermons. He was, as a fellow professional, deeply impressed by the oratory. For a long while he resisted taking in the content of Ambrose's sermons, but gradually the truth of what Ambrose was teaching crept into his heart. He felt he was beginning to be converted in his mind, but his emotions, his ambitions, his sexual needs held him back. He became, by degrees, convinced that there was more truth in the Catholic beliefs than he had imagined, and he became intellectually convinced of their truth. "I was on fire to imitate Ambrose," he writes. But to become a Christian like Ambrose would, he believed, involve him giving himself totally. He would have to embrace the whole lot, including, if he were to follow Ambrose's path, a life of celibacy. And he felt that he would be miserable unless, as he said, he was enfolded in the arms of a woman. Fortunately, books came to his aid. He was told to read the books of the Platonists. The teaching had a profound effect on his mental state. He discovered the inward road, the road that leads to the inner sacred space. His soul was on fire again. It brought back his desire that he felt when at 19 he discovered philosophy. He felt that he had found the real path to wisdom.
"These books helped remind me to return to myself. With you as guide, I entered into my deeper self. Because you were my helper, I was able to do this. I entered into myself, and with the eye of my soul, I saw the light within, the light which never changes. It shone on the eye of my soul. It shone on my mind. It was not the light of every day, which is seen by everyone, nor was it a magnified version of the same, as if that common light were shining far, far more clearly than it does, and were filling a vast space. This light within was not that. It was different, utterly different from any light we know."
The books of the Platonists set him again on the road to find happiness through wisdom. And this had the effect of his losing interest in worldly success and wealth. One day, a visitor from the court, an African and highly placed, dropped in to the villa of a friend, where Augustine and Alypius were having a break. The visitor was surprised to note that Augustine, with his reputation for being an unbeliever, was reading the letters of St. Paul. And he went on to tell the story of the monk and solitary, Anthony, whose life was bringing many into monasteries, and about two of his friends who, reading the life, had on the spot abandoned their careers in the emperor's secret service and instantly joined a monastery. When the visitor had left, Augustine was thrown into turmoil. He left Alypius and went down the little garden, and here is his account of that fateful day.
"From the very depths of my being, my probing mind drew up my weight of misery and gently placed it before my heart's gaze. I got up and moved away from Alypius, so that I might weep to my heart's content. Tears, I felt, were best shed in solitude. I moved well away, lest even this presence be a bar to my weeping. This was how I felt, and he sensed it. I said something, I don't know what, and my voice was heavy with tears. Moving away, I left him where he had been sitting. He was completely bewildered. Somehow, I flung myself down beneath a fig tree and let the tears flow. They flowed from my eyes in torrents, an offering acceptable to you. Maybe not in these exact words, but in some such, I kept saying over and over, "How long, Lord, how long will you be angry with us? Do not hold our past against us. Don't hold our past sins against us." For I felt that I was still in the grip of my failings. Desperately I cried, "How long? How long will I go on saying, 'Tomorrow and tomorrow'? Why not now? Why not in this very moment end my wretchedness?" These things I said as I cried my heart out in great bitterness. And suddenly I heard a voice from a neighbouring house. A voice, it seemed, of a little boy or girl repeating, "Take and read, take and read." I stopped weeping. Intently, I searched my memory, trying to think if there was any kind of game where children used this refrain. But never before did I remember hearing such words. I checked the flood of tears and got up, sure that this was a command from God to open the book of the Scriptures, and I read the first passage I might find. For I had heard that Anthony happened to hear the gospel being read and took as address to himself these words, "Go and sell what you have, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me." By this summons, he was instantly converted to you.
So I rushed back to where Alypius was sitting. When I stood up to move away, I had dropped there the book of Paul's letters. I grabbed it, opened it, and in silence read the first words on which my eyes fell. "Not in revelling or drunkenness, not in debauchery or licentiousness, not in quarrelling or jealousy. Instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Forget about satisfying your bodies with all their cravings." I didn't wish to read further. There was no need, for in an instant, as I came to the end of the sentence, it was as if a light of confidence flooded my heart, and the dark shadows of doubt were dispelled. I shut the book, marking the spot with my finger, or some other sign. With a face now completely calm, I told Alypius what had happened, and he related to me what had been going on in himself, of which I knew nothing. He asked to see what I had read. I showed it to him, and he read on further. I did not know what had followed. It was, "Accept the person who is weak in faith, him that is weak in faith receive." He applied it to himself and said so. This message gave him confidence. Without the agony of any hesitation, he joined me in the new determination and decision which came more naturally to him, for he was morally a far, far better person than I was. Then he went into the house to my mother and told her. She was overjoyed, and when we told her how it had happened, she became exultant, and blessed you who are able to do so many more than either asked or imagined. For she saw that in regard to me, for me, you had given her far more than she had ever asked in her anguished and piteous grieving. She had converted me to yourself to the degree that I no longer desired a wife. Not set my hopes any further on this world, I stood firmly now on the rule of faith in which you showed me to her in a dream years earlier. You turned her weeping into joy, into a joy far deeper than she had ever hoped for, far dearer and more precious than she had ever envisaged when she had wanted children from my flesh.
Late have I loved you, beauty ever old yet ever new. Late have I loved you. You were within me, yet I was outside. There I sought you as I rushed about among the beautiful things you had made. You were with me, but I was not with you. The beautiful things of this world kept me far from you. You called, you cried, you burst through my deafness, you scattered my blindness. I breathed your fragrance, and now I pine for you. I tasted you, and I hunger and thirst for you. You touched me, and I burn with desire for your peace. In our evening prayer tonight, the lesson, the short reading was, glory be to him who can do more for us than we can ever ask or imagine. A very suitable day, Father Ben, to give us this opportunity for the feast of the conversion of St. Augustine. And those of you who were at Mass this morning would be conscious, as I was, that as Jean was reading that last quotation from St. Paul's letters that Augustine heard over the fence, the voice that he heard over the fence of the passage that he read, you'll be conscious that that was the first reading at Mass today for the Feast of the Conversion. So all these things come together on such an occasion as this. So thank you, Father Ben. I must say I quite enjoyed the reading, because listening to your translation, because the translations that I have read often have a feeling of being very stilted. And this was very much at ease. And so thank you for the 16 years that you've put into this.
It's just a wonderful story.
It is. It is a wonderful story. Yes. And as Father Brian was saying to us today, that we are encouraged to look upon this story as our story as well. So thank you, Father Ben.